Our speaker today is Mrs. Catherine Graham, president of the Washington Post Company. Mrs. Graham was born in New York City and educated at Vassar College and the University of Chicago. From August 1938 to March 1939, she was here in San Francisco as a reporter on the San Francisco News. In April of 1939, she joined the editorial staff of the Washington Post, serving in the Sunday circulation and editorial departments. Currently, she is president of the Washington Post Company, a position to which she was appointed in September 1963. The company is the owner of the newspaper of the same name in Washington, D.C., Newsweek magazine, numerous radio and television stations, a co-venturer in the Los Angeles Times Washington Post News Service, and a co-venturer in the international edition of the New York Herald Tribune Washington Post. Mrs. Graham is the mother of four children and extremely active in civic affairs. She's a trustee of the Committee for Economic Development, the Urban Institute, George Washington University, and the University of Chicago. Her topic today is fairness and freedom of the press. We're pleased to present Mrs. Catherine Graham.
Justice Draper, Mr. Forsyth, ladies and gentlemen, to be in San Francisco today and to have an opportunity to talk to this very distinguished group about the news business gives me particular pleasure for two reasons. First, it's always a joy to come to this lovely city. And second, it's also something of a joy at this moment to get out of Washington, if only for a few days. It's not that I do not love the city and the community that I live and work in, but as some of you may know, a certain tension, which we hope and trust will be short-lived, has developed between the Washington Post and the administration over our coverage of the so-called Watergate affair. The Washington Post was central to the pursuit and public disclosure of most of what we now know about the story. And although the administration has not chosen to recognize this achievement with a silver trophy or even a parchment scroll, it has offered recognition of sorts in a spate of public attacks on the Post itself and on some of its individual employees. Taking this kind of heat is by no means an unprecedented experience for those of us in our profession. Still, it is nice to get out of the kitchen every once in a while. If it makes me a liberated woman, so be it. A certain degree of heat is, of course, a natural and expected part of our business. As Stuart Forsyth said, our company publishes a daily newspaper, The Post, and a weekly magazine, Newsweek, and it operates three television stations and two radio stations. When you're that much exposed to the critical judgments of that many customers with a brand new product every day, one that is different by definition from yesterday's product, the grievance rate is necessarily going to be high. It may be measured in somewhat the same way as the statistics on the number of babies being born every day in the world. Somewhere, at any given moment, it seems inevitable that somebody or something arising out of the operations of the Washington Post Newsweek Company is probably giving someone offense. I hope pleasure, too, and information. The controversy that has grown up over the Watergate affair, however, is of a different order from the sort of customer complaint that all of us in business receive on a regular basis. What we are now experiencing is something more than an automobile buyer's gripe about a faulty catch on the glove compartment. The administration is claiming defects in our coverage of the Watergate case, which some of its members seem to believe are grounds for wholesale, and some might say permanent recall. We do not, for some reason, agree with this judgment. But that's not why I bring the subject up or why I'd like to discuss it with you today. The performance of the reporters and editors on the Watergate story speaks for itself. And in our judgment, it speaks well for American journalism. That said, what I'd like to talk about today is the Watergate affair in terms of what it tells us about the state of relation between the news media on the one hand and the reading or viewing public in the largest sense of the word on the other. I have in mind those readers who are not in government as well as those who are. In other words, I want to discuss something of fundamental concern for us all. For what it really comes down to is nothing less than the state of the First Amendment, our freedom to gather the news and to publish it, and your freedom to read it. This is what we believe to be at stake in much of the controversy swirling around the press just now. And we find disturbing confirmation for this concern in a number of actions taken and tendencies shown by government at all levels and in all branches. These include such disparate-seeming activities as efforts to shake confidence in the purveyors of those news reports government does not like, and the singular effort in the case of the Pentagon Papers to restrain in advance the publication of the news. They also include efforts to challenge the claims of the press to the right to protect confidential sources and to refuse to disclose confidential information, even under court order. This last right is important enough to our profession that reporters are willing to go to jail to uphold it, and as you all know, have in the recent past. You may well be asking by now how the Watergate case fits in with all this, and the best way for me to answer that question is to recapitulate the essence of the Watergate affair, both the Post coverage of it and the government's response, and to talk a little about the questions which both raise concerning the responsibilities as well as the rights of the press. The charge that's been leveled against the Washington Post is that we have written extensively about the Watergate case out of a deep-down desire to damage the Nixon administration on the one hand and to elect Senator McGovern president on the other. On at least four occasions, surrogates for the administration made this charge in remarkably similar language prior to the election. And just last weekend, still another White House official reopened the argument, alleging that our handling of the Watergate story has been a tragedy and that the net impact was probably to erode public confidence in the institutions of government. He went on to share his worry that it had also eroded the confidence of a lot of fair-minded persons in the objective reporting of the Washington Post. While the official in question did not say which troubled him the most, his concern over public confidence in the Post struck us as not so much, perhaps, a worry as a hope. This is not a charge we can afford to take lightly, because it goes straight to the central issue of fairness and objectivity as distinct from bias in the reporting of news. These are familiar words. We were encountering them and dealing with them long before Vice President Agnew began his long campaign against the so-called elitist press. And we were encountering them, let me assure you, from all shades of the political spectrum, from left and right, from establishment and dissenter. I do not myself subscribe to the view held by some in journalism that engaging the wrath of both sides in a dispute means, as the saying goes, that we must be doing something right. On the contrary, it seems to me that one must not discount the possibility that we are doing everything wrong. I introduce the point only as evidence of a general and widespread discontent with the media at this time in history, and to suggest that our acknowledged failings do not begin to account for it entirely. Rather, it seems to me to be connected with a larger dissatisfaction and restlessness on the part of the public concerning its institutions as a whole. And to some extent, I think it also proceeds from our role as the bearer of much bad news. News of the foment and disorder of the 60s, for example, which, though not of our making, was ours to report. Ours to leave on the doorstep every morning, and ours to bring into the living room at night. We at the Post Company are aware of general crisis of confidence within the public concerning the news media. We are, I hope, also aware of the enormous obligations we have in attempting to deal fairly and responsibly with such sensitive, if different, events as a Watergate burglary or an unruly demonstration or march. We are aware that it is the danger of abusing our large and particular power in our news coverage and display, of overplaying and thus distorting the meaning of any given event. But I would suggest to you that these are much more difficult and potentially dangerous problems than our critics themselves seem to understand. For what our critics of whatever persuasion are often talking about when they speak of bias or lack of objectivity is merely something a newspaper or magazine publishes or a television station airs which does not serve their particular purposes at a given time. Thus, to this administration, we are fundamentally liberal and anti-administration. And this, supposedly, is why we cover the news in the general way we do. And also why we covered the Watergate story in particular the way we did. There is a much simpler explanation. We covered it in depth because it was major news, an important story from a national standpoint as well as from the standpoint of our own community. It would have been an equally important story, and we would have given it the same treatment regardless of which party was in power or who was running for election. Now, what exactly did happen? We were initially confronted with a highly unusual burglary, a burglary of the headquarters of a national political party, not for money, but for the purposes of bugging and tapping and stealing documents. It was obviously a police reporter story, and the editors put two of our best police reporters on it, despite the strong initial denials of the Democrats' natural antagonists, the Republican Party, and the President's Re-election Committee, that they were in any way connected with the burglary. Strong connections were soon demonstrated. One of the arrested men was security coordinator, both of the Republican National Committee and the Committee for the Re-election of the President. Another man soon connected with the case and subsequently indicted was a White House consultant. Once those links had been established in the face of categorical denials, journalistic professionalism and responsibility dictated that every possible lead be tracked down and checked out. As they went about their checking, our reporters turned up a number of extraordinary and entirely legitimate news stories. They found, for example, that a $25,000 check intended for the president's campaign had wound up in the bank account of one of the men arrested at the Democratic Watergate headquarters. They also learned that an additional $89,000 in the same suspect's bank account had not only been intended for the president's re-election effort, but had also been filtered through a Mexican bank to mask its origins. The pursuit of the leads also uncovered a network of political espionage and sabotage efforts directed at the Democrats. Finally, the reporters and other investigators turned up the fact that the sabotage operation was financed from a cash fund kept in the safe of the finance director of the President's Campaign Committee. I submit to you that these stories uncovered by our reporters and those working for other publications, far from being politically partisan, were in the highest traditions of American journalism. Once on their trail, our reporters had no choice but to pursue them. To have done otherwise would have been gross negligence, in part because this happened in Washington, where we have a large and skilled staff of reporters. The Post got out ahead on this story, but we were not alone in the developing interest in it. Now, as usually happens in an investigative story of this kind, we did have to rely on anonymous sources. Much of what we reported could not be stated categorically as fact, and in a totally conclusive way, because our informants were people intimately involved on one side or the other of the case. To have revealed their names would have been to risk their jobs and their careers. It would equally have been to eliminate their willingness to provide information, to have dried them up as news sources. However, a responsible paper can and does check one source against another. In all this reporting, the Post used 3 and sometimes 4 or more checks, and the work of the 2 main reporters was carefully rechecked by 3 or 4 separate editors. Time will tell how accurate our reporting has been. There are 3 pending court cases growing out of the Watergate affair, and there will almost certainly be congressional investigations by committees with subpoena powers. Sooner or later, we confidently expect that the sum and substance of our reporting will be confirmed and expanded upon, if all the facts are allowed to be brought out. It is nonsense to suggest that we could or would have pursued this story with as much intensity as we have done, out of some partisan motive and with nothing substantial to go on. To have done that would have been to gamble the reputation and fortunes of the Washington Post in an incredibly reckless manner, for the essentially elusive and, given the circumstances, forlorn political purpose of electing George McGovern. Yet that is precisely what some members of the administration are contending we did. Rather than respond on the merits to the disclosures that have appeared in the Post, they have by and large given us unambiguous and unsubstantiated denials, and beyond that, a continuing effort to discredit not the reports themselves directly, but the bearers of the reports, on the theory, presumably, that by doing this, the reports themselves would be disbelieved. Ironically enough, while accusing the Washington Post of reliance on anonymous sources, the administration itself has cited equally anonymous sources in an effort to impute ulterior motives to us. Based on these nameless sources, for instance, the suggestion has been made that out of some personal and, let me add, non-existent hatred for the president, I personally ordered a campaign against the Nixon administration in an effort to elect Senator McGovern, with whom I and others on the Post are alleged to have a curious, and I quote, social and cultural and ideological affinity. There are several things to be said about all this, and the first is that it's untrue. I have to interject that I met Senator Dole on the plane coming out here. I'd never met him before, and he's the one who happened to make that last charge on Face the Nation. And he came bounding across the aisle and said, "Hello, Mrs. Graham, I'm Senator Dole." And I said, "Oh, hello." And then I said, "Hey, I didn't say that." And if I did say it, if I had said anything that foolish, it would have no bearing whatsoever on our editors or reporters, because it doesn't work like that. And he said, "Well, it was a tough campaign." But next, and almost of equal relevance, it seems to me, is that it suggests an extraordinary innocence about the way a big newspaper or a news magazine functions, and, as I told him, about the way news is gathered. And because it ignores so much of the reality of these processes, it also entirely misses the real problem any news operation faces in its efforts each and every day to catch and set down the essence of fast-moving and only really dimly foreseeable events. By way of explaining how it actually works, let me begin by saying that the Post City Room numbers close to 400. Newsweek has a comparable workforce, and so in a lesser way do the newsrooms of the Post television and radio stations. They deal altogether and on a daily basis or weekly basis with millions of words, having to do with literally scores of news stories. In the case of the print media, the problem is one of compressing an enormous body of material into strictly limited space. In the case of radio and television, it is a problem of compression to meet the limitations of time. There is no way to calculate the number of individual daily judgments that have to be made by reporters in deciding what phrase or sentence to quote from a Supreme Court ruling, or an action by a local school board, and by layers of editors and copy readers in deciding what importance to give which story, how much to cut out of this, how much to expand that, and how prominently does it display each and every one. But it should be self-evident the decision-making on this comprehensive and detailed scale is beyond the effective daily control of any one individual, whether owner or publisher or editor. nor are the people who work in the Post Newsweek news operations indoctrinated in a party line. For one thing, we have none. For another, and more importantly, it is our conviction that sound journalism requires a sound professional basis. For when management allows business judgments or personal predispositions to influence the character of the news, it seems to me indisputable that both the public interest and our own professional excellence are substantially undermined. Finally, even if all this were not true, it has been our experience that good editors and good reporters, the kind of staff on which we insist and on which we depend, are not people who would submit to any such partisan and discreditable dictation. This is not to say that people in the news business are not human beings, subject to their own individual predilections and idiosyncrasies and preconceptions, and yes, obviously prejudices at times. But it is to say that no common overriding bias determines the end product. As for the notion that some uniform ideological affinity for Senator McGovern explains our handling of the Watergate case, I'd simply call your attention to some of the things we said about the senator's campaign. In one editorial toward the end of the campaign, we observed, "It will come as no surprise to those who have been reading our commentary on the candidates in this election so far that we have our profound misgivings about Senator McGovern's grasp of the essential techniques of political leadership." At another point, while his emphasis on urgent domestic needs may be admirable, the resultant foreign policy could well involve a considerable element of risk. And on Vietnam, we said that Senator McGovern had created a new moral problem in the crippling blow he would have this country deal itself and the Vietnamese ally as it made its way abruptly out of what it had originally proclaimed to be an ennobling enterprise. And finally, it can be argued issue by issue and in a conventionally compelling way that the burden of proof in the case for change is upon the man who would supplant a sitting president. And that George McGovern has failed to meet that burden convincingly. Not much affinity, cultural or otherwise, there. We do not pretend that this answers the question of unfairness or a lack of objectivity. These weaknesses are always a threat. But we try to guard against them in a number of ways. We've expanded reader access to our pages by doubling the space available for letters to the editor. We take pains to publish retractions and corrections. We've recently embarked on an effort to give the people in our community a greater opportunity to register their grievances face-to-face with our editors in a series of luncheon meetings in the surrounding counties of Maryland and Virginia and in the District of Columbia itself. We've been publishing in editorials and in signed columns on our editorial pages criticism of the news media in general and of the Post's own operation in particular. We have created an official ombudsman with the rank of assistant managing editor to conduct a continuing day-to-day monitoring of our performance and to deal with specific complaints from readers. Some indication of the seriousness and severity with which this self-criticism has been leveled upon us is to be seen in the fact that we have had to limit this assignment to 1 year, largely for the protection of the ombudsman. I should say that both the stations and Newsweek are trying to introduce disparate voices and self-criticism, too. It's not only limited to the Post, but I'm talking about the Post and the specific connection with the Watergate. We would not claim perfection, but we would make the case out of our own experience that something that might be called reader bias often exists and must also be taken into account. By that I mean that unfairness is often in the eyes of the beholder, especially when he feels some particular interest of his own has been adversely affected by what others would term a neutral news report. We are in business, after all, of describing people and their activities and their causes and conflicts. And it is a simple fact that people do not like to be described by others. The snapshot never looks quite the way you suppose yourself to look to others. It leaves this or that out of focus or out of the picture altogether. It highlights something else that isn't too flattering. It's not, in short, the way you would choose to describe yourself. It can't be. And that's why we so often hear somebody, and we've all done it, say, well, that can't be fair because I was there and that's not the way it was. Thus, we had Vice President Agnew in recent years assailing the press at a time when he thought the press was being unfair to the president. But in 1972, at a time when an overwhelming majority of American newspapers had endorsed President Nixon for re-election, and most papers were assiduously reporting imperfections and incompetency in the McGovern campaign, the Agnew crusade against the media suddenly stopped. It is significant in the same sense that when William Safire, White House speechwriter, and Frank Mankiewicz, the political director of the McGovern campaign, were asked on an NBC panel show during the campaign whether news coverage on the election had been fair, it was Mr. Safire who said yes, and Mr. Mankiewicz who said no. In the eyes of Mr. Agnew, we remain radic libs. In the eyes of Mr. Mankiewicz, as he wrote on our editorial page a few weeks ago, the Washington Post editorial page is a citadel of conservative chic. Bias, one discovers after a time in this business, must be very much in the eye of the beholder. Nothing may better illustrate this point than a really tough experience we had in reporting the shocking attack on Governor Wallace by a would-be assassin at a political rally in a Maryland shopping center just outside of Washington. The assault was a personal tragedy. It was also an event of great political significance. It took place by happenstance in our working territory. Our reporters knew the police and the hospitals and the general lay of the land. Thus, as with the Watergate affair, we were able to report before others did the hard and unhappy news that Governor Wallace had been wounded so severely that he would probably be permanently paralyzed. A development clearly of enormous political significance to the campaign. We took no pleasure in reporting it. The Wallace camp, understandably, took still less pleasure in our having done so. And so our news reports on the governor's medical condition were described to our disagreement with Governor Wallace's political views. Subsequently, however, these reports were borne out, and as we have every reason to believe, our reporting on the Watergate case will also be confirmed. The common denominator of both cases was that we were reporting something that somebody didn't want to hear. And so the first response on the part of many people was to suspect an ulterior motive on our part for having reported it. This is not a new phenomenon among readers, and the encouragement of such suspicions is not a new phenomenon on the part of government. Those of us who have been around through many administrations know that the Nixon administration did not invent governmental impatience with the press and does not have a corner on it now. There has been, however, a good deal of evidence of an intensified campaign to undermine public confidence, not just in the Washington Post, but in those segments of the news media which are thought to be hostile to the administration. To inhibit the functioning of the press, to sport with something that responsible public officials ought to be the first to uphold, the free flow of communications between the government and the governed. To this chorus, I would add the administration's supportive efforts on the part of state and federal attorneys to entangle professional newsmen in the law enforcement process by summoning them before grand juries and asking them to reveal confidential sources and information obtained in confidence. This is a new trend. It started only about 2 years ago and culminated with the government's successful argument in the so-called Caldwell case before the Supreme Court. In that case, a newspaper man's right to respect confidences was judged to be less important than the state's right to information upon which indictments could be brought against accused criminals. While respecting the Supreme Court's judgment, our own view is that confidentiality is the essence of news gathering. We could hardly operate entirely on the basis of information provided by sources who are prepared to have themselves publicly identified. And neither, we would add, could the government, for this business of anonymous attribution is used by both sides. That is to say, it is used in the dissemination as well as the gathering of news. We resist when the government seeks to put out unattributed information to large gatherings of newsmen under circumstances which conceal the sources only from the reader, but which enable the government to disclaim responsibility for what is written. This is an ancient government practice known in Washington as the backgrounder. We insist, on the contrary, on judging for ourselves on the validity of information gathered from anonymous sources, And it is our further view that the freedom to do just that is part and parcel of the freedom to publish. We would add above all the case of the Pentagon Papers. Although the Supreme Court ultimately ruled against the government in this case and freed us to publish these documents, the Times and ourselves experienced for a period of 2 weeks or more under temporary court orders requested by the administration the first prior restraint of publication in 200 years' history of this country. I would suggest that the we who experienced this unprecedented restraint is not an exclusive or exclusionary pronoun. It does not refer, in my judgment, merely to those publications that were engaged in litigation or even to the media as a whole. It refers to all of us, publishers and public alike. And I believe as well that the growing indifference to the First Amendment it reflects is cause for no less concern on your part, indeed on the part of every citizen, than on ours. For these are just not just our rights and freedoms, and this is just not our business. This is also your business, because these are also your rights and freedoms. When the press is intimidated and circumscribed in its capacity to report and to inform and to enlighten in its own fashion, it is the public that loses in the end by losing its capacity to participate in a self-governing society. This is not a matter of Republicans against Democrats or of liberals against conservatives, because sooner or later it will cut all ways. James Madison, in describing why our state constitutions included guarantees of freedom of the press, said this: "In every state, probably in the Union, the press has exerted a freedom in canvassing the merits and measures of public men of every description, which has not been confined to the strict limits of the common law. On this footing, the freedom of the press has stood. On this footing, it yet stands. Some degree of abuse is inseparable from the proper use of everything, and in no instances is it more true than that of the press. It has accordingly been decided by the practice of the states that it is better to leave a few of its noxious branches to their luxuriant growth than by pruning them away to injure the vigor of those yielding the proper fruits. We in the news business would ask of our readers and viewers only that they bear in mind this perception of the importance of a free press, whether they count a particular newspaper, news story, or newscast among its noxious branches, or among those yielding the proper fruits." Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mrs. Graham. And now, ladies and gentlemen, our traditional question and answer period will be conducted by the President of the Commonwealth Club of California, the Honorable Murray Draper.
If you'll be kind enough to return to the rostrum, we have a number of questions, only a few of which I've sorted out, and we'll try to ask in the time available. The first two are closely related, and I'll read them both. Do you see a time for more straight reporting and less editorializing? And the second, do you honestly believe the news columns or items of your publication and other media are unbiased and unslanted, giving only the who, what, why, and that only, and that only in their editorials do they become opinionated?
Speaking of editorializing, I think that we all agree that the who, what, when, where, why school of reporting, while it looks great, doesn't really tell you what's going on. if you follow that conclusion to its end, you deliver the dictionary. I think that what is going on now, as the world has become more and more complicated, and events from all over are more and more difficult to put in perspective, I think that what is called in that question editorializing is called by us news analysis. It's trying to tell the reader what really is going on. Because if you tell him, the example we all use is the way Senator McCarthy years ago in 52 used the press. It really is what started the new kind of reporting, the analysis. What he would do is every night at 6 o'clock release a statement saying there were 356 communists in the State Department. And every morning he would be quoted on the night news broadcast and again in the morning. And it took a while before we realized that you also had to say that he had said that before, that it had never been proved right. In fact, nothing he said had ever been proved right. It just really is not as simple as that question implies to tell people the truth.
And this question fairly summarizes a number. What are the most powerful pressures that influence editorial and news reporting?
The desire to do it well. I don't mean to be self-serving, although I am. But what I tried to say in the last half hour was there really are no pressures on us besides having professional people reporting and editing and trying in a very complicated world to get across to people what went on the day before or the week before in the case of Newsweek. People ask you if there are either business pressures or political pressures, and of course there are. And it's interesting that there are always in Washington worse political pressures because the White House is right there to either call you up or send somebody over, and so is Congress. And there are pressures. I mean, we've gotten pressures from the White House, and it doesn't start with this administration at all. President Johnson used to send over a whole bunch of thunderbolts every so on, you know, and Kennedy before him, and it's that. As it is well known, we're in an adversary position, and people on the other side try to influence you, but it's up to us to use our own best judgment. And I don't think we've occasionally get advertising pressure for some story, but I can't think of an instance in which, after a while, people don't come around.
This question may be somewhat provoking. If you could obtain, in some manner, full copies of everything in our CIA files, would you publish anything you felt would be newsworthy? And, the gentleman adds, and would boost circulation.
Again, the idea that we're out to boost circulation by flashy reporting is really demonstrably untrue. 85% of the Washington Post circulation is home delivered, and the amount we gain on a newsstand is absolutely negligible, and it darn sure wouldn't be increased by releasing the CIA files or any secret information much. The same is true of Newsweek, that their newsstand circulation is small compared to their total circulation and of no interest as far as flashy news is concerned. It doesn't help us. What does help us is a reputation for good reporting and intelligent reporting. Now, to get to the main point of that question about whether we would, how much secret information would we release, which is a very pertinent one, the duty of a paper or a publication is to tell people everything it knows. And I believe that once you start making judgments or picking out things that we think are good for people to know or bad for people to know, we're in real trouble. Now, you do, if the CIA files fell in our hands, which God forbid, the editors use their judgment. And I believe that is the way it has to be for responsible editors to use their judgment and their common sense. A lot of the sensitive things, the very few sensitive things there turned out to be in the Pentagon Papers, were spotted immediately by our editors and never had intended to be published. And although the government, when the case started, said there were 49 secret volumes, all of them classified by somebody who had made a full-time job of it, by the time we got through the court cases, there were 70, I think it was 27 phrases, parts of phrases or parts of sentences.
So.
We didn't steal the Pentagon Papers. Somebody brought them to us, and we then had to make the judgment about whether to publish or not. And I think that's entirely different from suggesting that we stole them. You can say they were stolen by somebody, but that's entirely different. Or purloined, or whatever word you want to use.
I think that's what the questioner meant to ask. Meant to say, stolen by others, but known to have been so.
Well, that's a different question. By the time we published them, they were brought to us, and they had, in fact, been published partly before. But that would not have influenced our decision. The decision was, do you want to have these volumes, look them over, and say, well, we don't think it's in the best interest of people to know what's going on. The fact is, actually, of the Pentagon Papers, almost everything in them, as was proved later, had been printed. The game of classification of documents in Washington is great. I mean, it employs millions of people. And some people say that you can't get a guy to read a document unless you stamp it classified. And actually, there are clerks who just stamp everything classified. And so, as I say, there turned out to be almost nothing that hadn't been printed or known publicly to all of our reporters in the Pentagon Papers.
Another question in connection with the Pentagon Papers. Is either the Washington Post Company or the New York Times currently involved in any legal action arising from the publication of the Pentagon Papers?
No.
There is,
as you know, there's a grand jury still meeting on in Boston.
Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you. And this calls for a rather wide-ranging judgment, judged on accuracy of news coverage and constructive public service. How would you rate our press versus that of England, West Germany, Italy, and Spain?
I just can't. It's very different. First of all, I don't really know much about European press. I've seen something of the British press. And it's just very different. Most of the British press is national, whereas the economy in this country more or less dictates local newspapers. And it's very hard, really, to compare them.
This question summarizes one which was frequently asked before and shortly after November the 7th. Do you believe scientifically conducted, responsible political poll reports on who's ahead now in presidential elections should be published in your newspaper? Do they contribute to the democratic process?
Yes, I think they do, in the sense that the polling techniques have been refined to what I think are really responsible results. We particularly have used polling in a kind of interesting way. We have two national political reporters, Haynes Johnson and Dave Broder, who, in collaboration with a poll made for us, where people were chosen scientifically to be interviewed by them, have gone around the country interviewing these chosen people with really awfully interesting results about how the country is thinking and what it's feeling. But I can see that polls upset things sometimes or that they influence events, and it bothers me a little bit, but I still think that the information contained therein is something that people want to read.
Mrs. Graham, we shall have time for but one more question, at the conclusion of your answer to which this meeting will stand adjourned. Before asking it, I extend to you the very sincere thanks of the Commonwealth Club of California for your most interesting comments and analysis of a problem that is an extremely difficult one in our country and will become more so in the future. We're deeply grateful to you for coming today to speak to us. Now, our last question is not always wholly serious, and I'm not quite sure in which class this one falls. Please comment on the role played by the media on the results of the last presidential election.
Let me just think. We're not supposed to play a role in an election. I think that we're supposed to bring people information on which they can make their decisions. And I think we did that I think the press in this country did that responsibly and well. Now, as far as the editorial opinion of the country is concerned, I guess most of the papers agreed with the landslide victory of the president. It's not always the case. Most of the papers were Republican, as you remember, and when Roosevelt was having his landslides. I think sometimes editorial opinion influences events, and sometimes it just doesn't. I don't really know quite why.
Thank you very much. Thank you indeed. Thank you very much.